Edmund today here with us. She's been continuously serving in ISPON since 1973. She was initiated by Srila Prabhupada in 1973 and again received second initiation in 1975. Her Grace has a Bachelor's of Science in Religion and Education, also in Educational Leadership as well. Her Grace's primary service is to research the job satisfactions of teachers in Krishna consciousness in primary and secondary schools. I've got a few from the list of services which Her Grace Mother Lumina has done and is still doing. So she's worked as a book distributor, assistant secretary for the BBT, but she's also been a pujari, a temple cook, actress, writer, editor, and she's also a feature writer and associate for Back to Godhead magazine. And I'm sure some of you must have seen that she also creates like children's Krishna books and stuff, because most of you guys, sort of Mataji, can write that you have some too. So without further ado, let's welcome Mother Lumila, and as we normally do, with three loud Hariwals, so...
Hariwal! Hariwal! Hariwal!
Her Grace Mother Lumila ki. Does anyone know what the class is on? Does anyone even remember?
So we're going to talk today about developing Vaishnava qualities. Actually, Vaishnava qualities are simply the qualities of the soul, the natural qualities of the soul. So developing Vaishnava qualities means realizing who we are, because who we are is wonderful. So there is a lot of religious philosophies in the world that say that human beings are created sinful, that humans are naturally sinful and you have to work really, really, really hard to be a good person. But we're saying that we're naturally godly, that we naturally have most of the qualities of God, and that it's simply a matter of remembering who we are. So if we think about it, I'm sure that all of us have an ideal picture of ourselves, some idea of ourselves of who we would like to be or who we hope that we are in our finer moments. Huh? So we have this, like I have this ideal Urmila up there. Huh? Do you all have that? Do you have an ideal? Not Urmila. You have your ideal self that you're kind of aiming for. And then you're trying to mold, we're trying to mold our decisions and our activities so as to live up to that ideal self, isn't it? Isn't that what we're doing?
Okay.
But honestly, I think most of us can say that we don't quite get there. So I'm assuming that all of us here like to think of ourselves as honest people. We're all basically honest people, yes? Yes? No thieves here? Well, anybody here prepared to say you're 100% honest? Anybody? Anybody ready to raise their hand? I'm 100% honest. No? Problem, isn't it? Or we generally think of ourselves as kind people, compassionate people, correct? Hopefully there's no secret serial killers here. But again, can anyone say, I'm 100% kind and compassionate? I'm always kind and compassionate. Anybody prepared to say that? So this is a problem for us, and I see it as one of the main problems that we have as conditioned souls, that who we would like to be and who we generally think of ourselves as being, we're not really that. You know, I might generally think, well, I'm a kind person, I'm a caring person, I'm an honest person, I'm a this and that and the other thing. But if I look honestly, I'd say, well, not always. It depends. Am I really like that? Is there any good quality that I can look at myself and say, I'm always like that? At least for myself, I can. Whatever good quality I like to think that I have and that I am, I see that there's many ways in which, if, you know, I'm deficient. And yet I have an idea that I'm generally like that. So a lot of what we're doing in our life is striving to be that idealized person, isn't it? Isn't that a lot of what we're doing? A lot of our actions in our life. I want to be the idealized self. But materially, it doesn't seem to work, does it? I also find this quite interesting. That you can take many courses, read many books, which will help, but they don't make it 100%. You know, they'll help. They can kind of raise the bar. You know, I can take some course and read some book and go through some kind of exercise that makes me more compassionate or more truthful or more responsible or more, but none of them seem to get me complete. There still seem to be so many times when I fail to meet my own ideals. And if we're really honest, those times are quite a bit more than we would like. Can we really say, I go a full 24 hours where all I've done this whole day is live up to my ideals? It's tough, isn't it? What to speak of a week? You say, I've gone for 1 week and I've never violated any of my ideals, even slightly, for the whole week. So it's difficult. And how ironic it is that which we are, our actual nature, is to be fully and completely full of all these good qualities. Without any break, without any other circumstance. And yet, it seems so difficult to really fully achieve it. Now, I also find it interesting that there's a lot of talk in modern society about values and about being a good person. That as society has become more and more secular. Do you know what secular is? Anybody want to give me a definition of secular? Anybody want to define what you mean by secular? Most of the world's governments today are secular. Most of the world's society are secular. What is that exactly? Some idea. You know, you can be wrong. It's okay. Just try.
Sectioned.
Okay. Sectioned off from? That's certainly true.
Society. From groups.
Okay,
fine. From groups.
Is it defined
religion? Yes. Yeah. Secular means? means that the world is seen and explained without reference to God and religion. Just like these children's books that we did, that some children were showing, and now those children have disappeared. Oh, you have a children's room, okay. Sounds like the disappearing children. So when we were working on those books, we had a team of devotees who gathered together children's reading schemes from most of the major English teaching publishers of the world. And what was absent in all of those books? God, not just Krishna. Any religion was just not there. Just wasn't there. There was no reference to anything religious at all. No one in the books ever prayed. No one in the books ever went to a church or a temple or a mosque. When they showed religious-based holidays, they were without religion. So they show a family celebrating Diwali, but there was no mention of anything religious. It was just, what food do they eat? And they light some lamps. Do you follow what I'm saying? So that's a secular society says, we do not need God to give meaning to life. We are going to understand everything in life in ways other than referencing God or spirituality. Well, then how do they explain things? What is society using to explain things?
Science.
Okay. Psychology. Evolution. Economics. People act this way because of this. Because of this economic factor. There's natural disasters because there's just these things that happen in the universe. You know, everything is explained in terms of something mechanistic, in terms of some sort of impersonal forces that have nothing to do with spiritual life. And then secularism also applies to our own personal lives. So not only does society in general explain everything without reference to God, but individuals also do. So when individuals look at their own life story, why did this happen to me? Why am I in this situation? They explain it in ways without reference to God. Well, I have this disease because I ate the wrong kind of food. Right. You understand? Everything is explained in that kind of way. So most of the world society today are secular. But you will find that in most of the world society today, there's a push towards values. They don't want to talk about God. They don't want to talk about religion. They don't want to talk about anything spiritual. But they do want to talk about values. They want to talk about honesty and responsibility. Yes? The irony is, and we'll explain why in a moment, that if you don't have reference to spirituality and God, you can never fully achieve values. It's impossible. The attempt to really be the kind of person you want to be on the material level is not possible. It doesn't matter how many courses you take. It doesn't matter how much you study. It doesn't matter how dedicated you are. There's a limit. You'll have those values under some circumstances, and you won't have them under others. Now, there's several lists of the qualities of a devotee, and we could refer to a number of these different lists. There's, of course, the list of the 26 qualities of a devotee that's given by Mahaprabhu to Sanatana Goswami, as also explained in the 11th canto of the Bhagavatam. There's the list of the 50 qualities of the perfected jiva that's given in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu and also the Nectar Devotion. So we're going to look here in the Bhagavad Gita at some of the qualities of a devotee that Krishna lists. We're going to look first at the 16th chapter where he lists the divine qualities. Fearlessness, also known as courage. Purification of one's existence, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, charity, self-control, performance of sacrifice, study of the Vedas, austerity, simplicity, nonviolence. Can you think about these? Because I'm going to ask you which ones you want to talk about. So don't just shut your brain off because I'm reading. I don't know why people do that, but Somehow, when as soon as somebody picks a book and starts to read, everybody goes, oh. It's like a switch. What did I say? You must have learned that in school because everybody does it. So I'm gonna try this again. So please listen. And if there's one of these that you really like that catches your attention, then because I'm going to ask you which ones you want to talk about. Okay? Right. Fearlessness, purification of one's existence, cultivation of spiritual knowledge, charity, self-control, performance of sacrifice, study of the Vedas, austerity, simplicity, nonviolence, truthfulness, freedom from anger, renunciation, tranquility, aversion to fault-finding, compassion for all living entities, freedom from covetousness, gentleness, modesty, steady determination, vigor, forgiveness, fortitude, cleanliness, freedom from envy, and freedom from the passion for honor. So that's one list of the divine qualities. Another very wonderful list is in chapter 12. Where Krishna says, what are the qualities of a devotee that are very dear to him? And these are worth regularly reading. This is starting in text 13 in chapter 12. And again, if you can try to really hear when I'm reading this, and again, if there's one or two you hear and go, oh, I mean, I can pick what I want to talk about, obviously, but if there's something that you really like to discuss, that would be even better. Okay, starting with 14. One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor, is free from false ego, equal in both happiness and distress, tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, engage in devotional service with determination, mind and intelligence fixed on me, on Krishna. This one is like, this is text 15. He by whom no one is put into difficulty, in other words, he never puts anyone else into difficulty, and who is not disturbed by anyone. So no one can disturb you. Who is equal poise in happiness and distress, equal poise in fear and anxiety, is very dear to me. Text 16. Who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, not striving for some results. Text 17. One who neither rejoices nor grieves, neither laments nor desires, renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things. 18, 19. Equal to friends and enemies, equal poised in honor and dishonor, equal poised in heat and cold, equal poised in happiness and distress, equal poised in fame and infamy, always free from contaminating association, silent and satisfied with anything, doesn't care for any residence, fixed in knowledge, engaged in devotional service. Such a person is very dear to you. Impressive, huh? Whenever I read those, I feel at least a little humble. If you ever are dealing with pride, at least for me, you know, it works for me. You just pull out those verses and go. So how is it that only through bhakti, only through advancement in spiritual life, do we really become... Wouldn't it be nice to be like that? I mean, wouldn't it be nice? If we had all those qualities, we would be what? How would we feel? You'd feel very happy. What else? You feel very what?
Peaceful.
Very peaceful. What else? Very clean. Very content. How else would you feel if you had all those qualities?
Tolerant.
Very tolerant, yeah. What else?
Free.
Free. You'd be very free and pure. Basically, you'd be in a situation where nothing and nobody could affect you. We'd be very equipoise. We find these a lot of these qualities are dealing with being equipoise, aren't they? How interesting that the conditioned soul wants to be the master. And as soon as you want to be the master, then you're actually just thrown around by the different circumstances of the material world. And you're not free at all. And as soon as you actually become a servant of Krishna, you become free. And when you're free, in one sense, you really are the controller of your own life and your own self, aren't you? You're no longer controlled by circumstances or by others. You can always be the kind of person you want to be, and always be the kind of person you are, regardless of circumstances, regardless of the behavior of others. Wouldn't that be nice? So why is it that only through devotional service can one get this? And again, how ironic that by surrender to Krishna and service to Krishna, we become free and we actually get self-control. We become in control of ourselves. We become actually in control of our life and control of our destiny. Whereas as soon as I try to be the controller, then I become affected. Somebody says something I don't like and I'm totally affected. Isn't it? Something happens I don't like and I'm affected. Something happens that I really like and I'm very affected. I'm just thrown about by these waves of circumstance. Why is spirituality the deciding factor? Why does a secular society that focuses on values unable to achieve individually for its members or collectively for its members a state where people are really like this all the time? So the answer to this comes from the first quality in chapter 16. Any chance any of you remember what that was? Oh, very good. Who said that? Oh, well, thank you. I thought, I bet you nobody's going to remember. Fearlessness. That's the first of the divine qualities. Someone who's fearless is filled with... What do you feel with? If you have no fear, then what do you have?
Courage.
You have courage. And you also have what else? If you're not afraid, what are you feeling?
Mm-hmm.
You're content. You're feeling peacefulness. And you're feeling peace. Krishna says early in the Bhagavad Gita, you cannot have happiness without peace. Sometimes people think courage means that you're terrified, but you act anyway. But no, real courage means that you're peaceful. I'd like you to think for a minute about, and I'm sorry to do this to you, but it'll be good. Trust me on this. So think about the last time, hopefully it was a long time ago, but think about the last time that you failed to live up to your ideals in any area. And if you think about that, you'll realize that there was some kind of threat. There was some circumstance that was threatening in some way. Something was being threatened. A relationship was being threatened. Money was being threatened. Something that you felt you really wanted or maybe even really needed was being threatened. What we will do is we will be honest or compassionate or tolerant or responsible as long as the threat is not severe enough. Isn't that when we become dishonest? When we get scared of something? When we think, well, if I'm honest, I'll damage my relationship, or if I'm honest, I might lose my job, or if I'm honest, yes? Isn't that what it is? For most people, I mean, some people perhaps are just dishonest, whatever, but for most people. And the same with being caring. You know, when do we say something nasty, or do something nasty and harmful? If we think we have some good reason. Well, something bad will happen if I'm compassionate in this situation. I have a reason. And if you think about what the reason is, try to notice this. Hopefully you'll never do this again. But anyway, if it happens, notice that there's always some sort of fear involved. And this is why secular societies cannot actually have high values. They don't eliminate fear. if I'm this body, then I'm going to be full of fear, aren't I? How fragile are these bodies? Who here has ever broken a bone? Anyone here ever broken a bone? Did you have to do something severe to break a bone? It doesn't take that much, does it? I broke a toe once just by walking into a chair. You know, they're very fragile. Or you get sick. Is it easy to get sick? Even if you really try to be healthy. It doesn't take much, does it? These bodies are very, very fragile. And we know that the body, for sure, 100%, is going to die. So if I think on this body, I'm filled with fear. Have to be. There's no option. And if I think that my happiness is coming from the things of this world, I'm also going to be filled with fear. Because the things of this world are not under my control. Are they under anybody's control? Anybody here can control things of this world? Anybody can do that? Anybody here? No? Problem. So if my happiness depends on having enough money, can anybody here absolutely guarantee they're going to have enough money for the rest of their life? If my happiness depends on having, you know, nice, caring relationships, is that totally up to my end of things? Isn't that also up to the other person's end of things? Can I completely control what other people do? No, you can't. If my happiness depends on stability in government, not being war, can we control our governments? I mean, we'd like to think that we can, but can we control our governments? Can anybody say, I'm going to make sure my government doesn't go to war? I'm going to make sure my government doesn't have some bad economic policy? I mean, you can write them a letter, you know. Somebody will read it, I suppose. So as long as I think I'm this body, and as long as I think my happiness depends on things in this world, then everything I'm depending upon is shaky. So therefore, I'm going to be afraid. Does that make sense to everybody? So therefore, a secular society which says you are just a material being cannot induce peace in people. Impossible. You cannot have peace if you think you're a material being and you think your happiness comes from material arrangements. You just can't. I mean, you can try to say, well, I'm going to decide to be peaceful with it, but you just can't. I'm going to be peaceful with the idea that everything I need is shaky and not under my control. How do you do that? Is it possible? If you really need something, not just you want it, not just like I want a, you know, purple hat or something, but something you actually need, like life and happiness. And if you're dependent on something that you can't depend on, where are you going to find your peace? The only way you can find peace is if what you depend on is dependable. Duh. You invest your money in securities. I love that term. Yes? What do they call that? The securities? Is it secure? Will any banker tell you, are investments 100% secure? Even if it's backed by the government. Is the government 100% secure? Have governments fallen? The great British Empire. I was just recently in Spain for the first time, and the Spanish people are still not happy that they lost the fight with the Armada. That's serious. It's a scar in the collective psyche of the Spanish people that they were once the rulers of the world. Do you ever think about that? Spain was once the ruler of the world. British never liked to think about that. So, you know, governments are shaky. Sometimes whole countries disappear and then get reformed in another way. So even if you're relying on the government. So therefore, the only way to find peace is to realize that I am indestructible and I cannot be harmed. I am eternal. I am a spiritual being, and the source of all of my needs is God, is Krishna, who is also indestructible. I'm an indestructible being, permanently hooked up to an indestructible source of everything that I need. Now, if one realizes that, would one ever be afraid of anything? Yes? No? Would we ever be afraid of anything? If you could realize, I am an indestructible being. I am an unharmable being. I cannot be harmed in any way. I, as a soul, I'm incapable of, as a soul, of experiencing any sort of injury on any level. Emotional injury, physical injury. I'm incapable of sustaining any sort of injury. I'm a soul. And everything I need, as a soul, I'm connected to the Supreme Soul who's giving me eternally everything I need. Then immediately peace. And when there's peace, then also immediately detachment. You see how that'll bring detachment? I don't need anything. You say, well, I need it for the body, but I'm not the body. Well, if I don't get it, the body will die, so. It's like if you had a stain on your clothes and it couldn't come out, and someone said, well, then if you can't get out, you have to throw it away. Well, so? Do any of you, are any of you so poor that you worry if you have to throw away a piece of clothing? No. Right? Nobody here is that poor? I hope. If you are, we'll talk later. Do a community effort, tell me that. I mean, you may feel sad at maybe your favorite sock or something. You really like that sock. That you can get another sock. You're not required the sock in order for your existence. So one on this level of consciousness, you know, they try to sustain the body to be used in service and self-realization, but they don't consider that the source of their happiness, nor are they affected by the pains and pleasures of the body or the world. They're existing on another platform. And someone existing on this platform in full peace can always do what's right without fear. Again, we stop doing what's right because we're afraid if I do the right thing in this circumstance, I'll suffer. Huh? I want you to think also, if we only do the right thing when we're not worried about the consequences, that means we're much more interested in self-preservation than in doing the right thing. Just a little sign. That if I'm truthful only up into a point, then one can say, in one sense, that I'm not really truthful at all. That really what I am is interested in self-preservation. And I will be truthful as long as it's compatible with self-preservation, and as soon as it's not compatible with self-preservation, then I won't be truthful. Does that make sense to anyone? Therefore, Bhagavatam says that one who's not a devotee ultimately has no good quality. Someone who's not realized has some good qualities temporarily in some circumstances, but you can't really say they have good qualities. So the actual way to become who we want to be and who we really are is to become who we really are spiritually. There is not a material solution. Material solutions may help. It may bring you from ignorance to passion to goodness. And if you're in passion rather than ignorance, your line will be higher. You follow? So if a person's in the mode of ignorance, they're going to become fearful very quickly at very minor things. And therefore, they're going to give up their good qualities very quickly. I saw this in the airport yesterday. So somebody, we were in the queue, and this woman ahead of me, she turns to some other passenger and says, don't call me dear. I'm not your dear. Don't patronize me. become so fearful because a stranger said, somebody said, oh dear, you can go ahead of me. And somehow that she felt threatened by that. She felt, this person is patronizing. This person is threatening my self-respect. You follow? And because she felt threatened, she behaved in a not socially acceptable way. She wasn't behaving in a kind or considerate way to anybody else in the area. Does that make sense to you? So somebody who's in the mode of ignorance, they're threatened by a very small thing. Their level of peace is very, very low. Someone in the mode of passion, it's higher. And someone in the mode of goodness, it's higher. But only when one's in pure goodness is there no line at all. Is there no point at which someone says, oh, okay, I've got to act this way in order to preserve myself. So that's the only cure. Just having some kind of values education and some this or that or the other thing, it might help you to act more in passion than in ignorance. It might help you to act more in goodness or in passion, but it's not going to fully solve the problem. And therefore we find that as long as we stay on that material level, we disappoint ourselves. And you may even think, I thought I got this. I thought I conquered this. I thought I was able to do this. Why am I the circumstance now where, again, I've disappointed myself? So the only cure is actually enlightenment and self-realization. So someone have a particular quality that they'd like us to look at, that particular quality. Ooh, aversion to fault finding. That one is particularly interesting because that is the only quality that Rupa Goswami gives in the Nectar of Instruction, Upadeshamrita, as indicative of the top level of a devotee. In text 5, he says there's the beginning, intermediate, and advanced devotee. And for the advanced devotee, he gives two qualities. One is they always love Krishna without any stopping. Well, we expected that. Yeah? What is a pure devotee? Well, a pure devotee loves Krishna without any stopping. That's almost the definition of a pure devotee. Yes? But then he gives one other thing. He says their heart, sunya ridaya. Sunya means zero. Ridaya is heart. There's zero inclination in their heart to find fault with others. So interesting. That of all the qualities, like we listed so many qualities, of all of the qualities, Rupa Goswami picks that one and says, this one is really indicative of who's on the highest level of bhakti. Now, it's also interesting that he doesn't just say the person who doesn't say critical things, but he's saying the person who doesn't have any inclination in their heart to say critical. So you might want to try an experiment, and I tried this several years ago. You might want to try an experiment and say, okay, I'm going to go for one day without saying anything critical, even slightly, about anybody. And my guess is that what will happen is you'll start noticing how many times during the day you say critical things, which you probably don't notice, but try it. Just say, like, say, okay, today, one whole day, I'm not going to say anything critical about it. And when I tried this many years ago, and the first thing I noticed was, wow, I say a lot of critical things about a lot of people all the time. And then even if you can stop saying something, the thoughts are there. And it's amazing what we criticize people for. At least for me, I don't know if you all struggle with this, but it's just amazing how the ridiculous things that we find fault with in others. Shoes they wear, or something, you know, that we just pick on it. And what are we doing when we're fault finding, generally? What are we really doing? Trying to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. I'm better than that. Well, I don't have that problem. At least I would never wear those shoes. Well, I'd never get upset in a queue in the airport if somebody called me dear. At least I'm not like that. I mean, so it's basically a way of saying, you know, I'm better. So why is it that a person who's advanced spiritually doesn't have any inclination to do that? Why?
Because I'm not attached to the team.
Definitely not attached to the team. What are they getting? Again, if our main reason for fault finding is to feel good about ourselves, why doesn't a self-realized person feel any need to fault find? Because they're already happy with themselves. If I see that I'm a soul, and I have qualities, most of the qualities of God, why would I need to feel good about myself by criticizing somebody's hairstyle? Or somebody's whatever? It would be irrelevant. Isn't that interesting? So the more we realize who we actually are, and then we see everybody's a soul. Everybody's part and parcel of God. I'm not better than anybody, and nobody's better than me. We're all equal as souls. Pandita Samadarshina. And I don't have to be better than anybody in order to be perfect and wonderful. I mean, logically we can understand that even if everyone else is a fool, I could still be a fool too. Logically. Yes? Does that? Yes? Even if everybody else is a fool, that doesn't make me not one. So no matter how many faults I find in others, doesn't say anything about me. Everyone else could be irresponsible, and I could be too. But once you realize that you're a soul, then you have no urge to do that. You're already satisfied. And although as souls we're all equal, each of us has an individual nature, which is especially dear to Krishna. So Krishna especially loves me for who I am, and he especially loves you for who you are, and especially loves you for who you are. Sanatana Goswami says that everyone in the spiritual world thinks I am Krishna's favorite, and they're all right. So when one starts to realize that, then one no longer has a need to try to feel distinct and special in foolish, artificial, external ways. Any other quality that anybody would like to talk about? Yes?
Self-control.
Self-control. Okay, so self-control can be done on a temporary repression, suppression level, and we all have to do some of that sometimes, but that's not the kind of self-control that Krishna's talking about. I mean, obviously, all of us have to do some suppression and repression, or we couldn't be human. But if that's our main means of self-control, it doesn't last. I'm sure you all notice that. Suppress, 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 explode. Some people raise their children like that. Oh, it's okay. Oh, it's okay. Oh, it's okay. Poor kid. So, and some people's marriages are like that. Yes, do whatever you want. Yes, whatever you want. If you're doing that kind of thing, please make some changes in your life, because that's a really bad idea. So the kind of self-control we're talking about here is parandrisvamivartite, that one is experiencing something better. That one is experiencing something better. You know, any of us who used to eat meat, once you start eating prasadam, you don't have to use repression not to go to McDonald's. Interesting. Naturally. So real self-control must come from having a higher taste. Suppression, repression is useful for short periods of times in emergencies, but it cannot be the method of choice. And it's not what self-control is really about. Self-control is having a higher taste and higher principles, higher goals. If one has a goal of spiritual, you're focused on that goal. And the more you focus on the spiritual goal, and the more you control yourself because you're focused on that goal, the more you'll get taste of spiritual, of real spiritual freedom and real spiritual peace. And then you'll see that that's so much more pleasurable than whatever it is that you were controlling. Can we take one more? Yes?
I think you mentioned freedom from covetousness.
Freedom from covetousness, yes. Not wanting to have what others have. So this can be very difficult. I was speaking the other day to somebody who did something really wrong. And she said to me, well, I felt that I was cheated in my own life. You know, I didn't get what I needed in my own life. And therefore, I was, you know, I could do this thing and take this thing. So this is the general reason that we covet. That we're thinking, you know, I got a bad deal. I didn't get what I deserve. I didn't get what I need. And why does this other person have it and I don't? You know, why does this person have more money than I do? Why does this person have a nicer wife or a nicer husband? Or why does this person have a better job? Or why does this person have better health? Or why does this person have, you know, a more attractive body or whatever? You know, why can't I have it? They're not better than I am. And I'm not a bad person and so forth and so on. So this is, of course, due to not accepting that whatever situation we're in is due to our own behavior in this life and in the past lives. And that everything is fair and that everything is just. And that what we have is perfect. And that no material situation is going to fully satisfy us. It's not that if you had that car, or if you had that kind of hair, or if you had that kind of husband, or you had that kind of job, that then you'd be fully satisfied. You wouldn't be. And of course, if you live that other person's life, then you would see that they're not satisfied either materially. That's just reality. The person who has the computer, or the person who has the job, or whatever that you wish you had and you think you deserved, if you had it, it's not that you'd say, well, I find satisfaction. It's not going to be the source of our satisfaction. And anyone who tries to get satisfaction materially is cheated. And ultimately, coveting something will get us another body where we can get to try it. So if that, because ekobhamanam yovididati kaman, Krishna fulfills all desires. Not in some kind of new agey way that you just sit in your living room and go, red jaguar, red jaguar. You open your eyes and there it is in your driveway. I mean, if you have property city, you can do that. But generally speaking, that's not how it works. But how it does work is that Krishna is in the heart and he hears and he feels the desires of the living entity. And if you're thinking, you know, I want the red jaguar, but you don't have the karma to get it, then Krishna will give you the advice as to how to get the karma to get it. But you may not be able to amass the karma to get it in this life. Depends on what karma you're already starting with. And so it may get you another life. Especially if you covet things that are just impossible in this life, in this particular body that you have. You know, if you covet being an Olympic athlete and you have the body I have, it's just not going to work. Then you have to get another body before. So it's very risky looking at other people's situations and other people's possessions and so forth and so on and saying, I wish I had that. And if only I had that, then I would be happy. Because there is somebody who hears your desires. And there is somebody who says, okay, sure. And will then direct you, will give you direction from within your heart to do the activities that will give you the opportunity to get those things. If you already have the good karma, you'll just get them. And if you don't have the good karma, you'll be put in a situation where you can amass the karma to get them. And it keeps you in this world so that you can try this and that and the other thing. Okay, let me experience having this kind of job. Let me experience having this kind of wife, this kind of husband, this kind of house, this kind of this, this kind of. We try this situation, that situation, that. Till finally we, oh, it's not the situations. kind of nose I have, or what kind of hair I have, or what kind of job I have, or what kind of this I have, or what kind of that, or whatever. It's how realized I am, and we finally wake up to it. So why not just do that from the beginning and say, you know, why should I desire something that somebody else has? None of it's going to bring me happiness anyway. And once you, it's also funny that once you have something, you're generally not very aware that you have it. It just becomes normal. The things that each of us has stuff that other people want, you know. You know that, right? Yeah? And we all have something nice in our life. That someone, there's someone in the world who doesn't have, and there's somebody who's going to look at our life and say, I wish I had that. Yes? But many times we're not even aware of it. Recently in Italy, I was at one of our temples where we have a lot of peacocks, and it's mating season. Poor peacocks, we have like three peacocks and one pea hen there, so they're all competing with them. Well, at least while I was there, she wasn't interested in any of them. But one thing that struck me was that the peacock is not aware of its own beauty. I mean, they must have some awareness of it, but not really. It's not that the peacocks are going and admiring themselves in the mirror. You know, they don't really have a sense of that. And it's like that even for us as human beings. We don't generally have much of awareness and appreciation of our own opulences. We tend to focus on what we lack rather than what we have. So even if you got all those things that you wanted that other people have, once you got them, you would be very unaware of them, and they would just be part of your life, and you'd again focus on what you lack. Yes. So these are some tools to help. So thank you very much. Oh, where is the show?
What time do we have to leave, Tom? No, what time do we actually have to leave to get back so that we can get in?